Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, Joseph Lelieveld revisits Gandhi's years in South Africa.
And Gandhi became their spokesman, their petitioner against unjust laws, and gradually he assumed a kind of public identity.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. The Times' John Schwartz tells us about the political Will Rogers.
People didn't just suck up to him because he was on the radio. He was actually exchanging ideas with people and was respected for it.
And Jennifer Schuessler has bestseller news. Joseph Lelieveld is one of America's most renowned and honored journalists, Pulitzer Prize winner, former executive editor. That's a top job at this newspaper. And one of the great foreign correspondents of our time. He's written an important new book. It's called Great Soul, Mahatma Gandhi and His Struggle with India. It's reviewed for us this week on the cover by Jeffrey Ward, who says, Great Soul is vivid, nuanced, and clear-eyed. I'm delighted that Joseph Lelieveld is here to talk about the book. Welcome, Joe.
Great to be here.
So we have Gandhi in South Africa. Who was he? How old was he when he went there, and what happened to him there?
He was 23 years old. He had qualified as a barrister in London and then returned to Bombay, where he tried to set up a legal practice, quite unsuccessfully. And he was offered sort of a one-year deal to serve as a law clerk, in effect, which is a downgrading for a qualified barrister, in a legal case involving some Indian Muslim traders in Durban, South Africa, or Durban-Natal, actually, as it was at the time.
And when was this, Joe?
1893. Before the Boer War, it's just after the discovery of gold in South Africa, which transformed the whole politics and economics of that part of the world. Gandhi arrives there. The standard portrait is that he's a shy, withdrawn young man, and he's shocked into consciousness, political consciousness, by incident of racial discrimination on a train. This is sort of the way Richard Attenborough has it in the movie, the way Philip Glass has it in his opera. I've tried to reread these texts with a fresh eye, and what struck me is that on his first day in South Africa, he walks into a law court wearing a turban, and the judge instructs him to take off the hat, bare his head, and
because it's disrespectful.
In the judge's eyes, Gandhi stalks out. The next day, there's an article in the local newspaper with the headline, An Unwelcome Visitor, and recounting this little scene in the courtroom of this funny Indian. There were no Indian lawyers in South Africa. He was the first. Gandhi then writes a letter to the newspaper in which he says, no, it's a mark of respect for an Indian to keep his head covered. And he's sort of mocking of the whole tone of the newspaper article and of the judge. That struck me very forcefully because I thought you can't really begin the story of Gandhi in South Africa with the incident where he's thrown off the train. You've got to begin it there, where he strikes back in a characteristically witty way against what he regards as prejudice.
And Joe, you say that Gandhi expected that his stay in South Africa would be brief.
Yes.
He was there for 21 years.
That's
why?
Right. Well, there are two reasons. One is he didn't have a livelihood to go back to, really. And secondly, he pretty soon became indispensable to the small Indian community there as a kind of, I use the word mouthpiece, for the Muslims who, traders who were sort of the upper class of this new immigrant community. And Gandhi became their spokesman, their petitioner to against unjust laws, and gradually he assumed a kind of public identity and a public role. And gradually he became Gandhi.
Joe, one of the great themes in the book is the complexities still important today of the caste system in India. And as Jeffrey Ward points out, for most readers, you actually introduce us to a new important figure who was an adversary of Gandhi's. Tell us about him.
That's Ambedkar, who is a great figure in India, but aside from some academic studies, isn't widely known outside of India. Ambedkar was an untouchable, and I should say what an untouchable is. Under the caste system, there are four main groups of castes, and then there are those who are beyond the pale, beyond caste, and the untouchables, with whom, at various degrees, contact with them becomes polluting in the view of caste Hindus who are most Hindus. And they're kind of oppressed minority. Ambedkar, he was an untouchable himself by birth, but extremely well-educated. He had doctorates from both Columbia and the London School of Economics. And I think he started out somewhat as an admirer of Gandhi, because Gandhi had always been very forthright on the issue of untouchability. He thought of it as his kind of signature issue. And Ambedkar comes along and wants more from Gandhi. He wants an outright rejection of the caste system, which he doesn't get for many years. Their relationship fascinates me, and I return to it repeatedly in the book, but the central moment is a confrontation in London between them in 1931 at a constitutional conference, where they're talking about the electoral system that will exist in India, and Gandhi and he clash directly, and Gandhi basically vows to lay down his life to prevent Ambedkar from realizing his aims. In fact, a year later, when he's in prison, begins a fast unto death, he calls it. It's, I think, a pivotal episode in Gandhi's life. And I describe Gandhi and Ambedkar as sort of secret sharers, using the Conrad term. They understood each other. They were attracted by shared values in many respects, but they could never quite cooperate except for a few days or weeks at a time. And then they would come back, they would blow apart, come back together. Ambedkar was incredibly sensitive and thin-skinned. Gandhi said, well, he has the right to spit on me. Can you consider the all the abuse we give his people?
Joe, one of the points you make in the book, and Jeffrey Ward does in his cover review, is that you take us from the young Gandhi, whom we see it almost looks like a young Fareed Zakaria, very elegantly turned
Fareed
out.
Fareed will be happy to hear that.
Very Anglo in his style and affect, to the famous figure we think of now. What trajectory did he follow to get from one place to the next? How did he become this spiritual and political figure, wrap all these kind of struggles into one being?
It's a continuous process of reinvention on his part and self-creation. He was more involved with religion at first than politics, distinctly more. Religion and politics were never disentangled once he got into politics. The sartorial side of it, you can almost call it his striptease, begins in South Africa when he gives up his stylish British clothes and gradually dresses down almost like a hippie of the 70s, and then starts shifting into Indian clothes. And before he leaves South Africa, at a couple of climactic moments in his last great struggle there, he appears in Indian dress, meaning to wear the clothes of the most downtrodden laborers, Indian laborers working on the sugar plantations and in the coal mines of Natal. He continues doing that in India. And we have a lot of pictures in the book. And when you sort of thumb through the book, you can almost see the progression, which finally ends in the image of Gandhi most people know, of him in his loincloth and shawl and bare-chested, which he finally reaches around 1922 after being back in India for 7 years. One of his biographers, Robert Payne, describes it as his symbolic disguise. Gandhi's own explanation was that we must dress the poor first before we dress ourselves. We must feed the poor first before we feed ourselves. It becomes a whole social cause for him, an expression of his moral ambition to transform Indian society. I suggest, perhaps not as forthrightly as I as I'm going to say it now, but I suggest in the book that in a way, as he does this, he makes himself look more like a Hindu holy man. And that is perhaps alienating to Muslims. Unity, cooperation with unity, was one of Gandhi's great causes, going all the way back to South Africa and the fact that he was originally hired there by Muslim traders. His first political speeches were in mosques. Without Muslim support, he might never have become the leader of the Indian National Movement. But as he goes on this trajectory, in their eyes, he seems perhaps less universalist in his appeal and more Hindu.
And what is his legacy today? This is one of the great figures of the 20th century. What is his legacy in India and also in South Africa, if there's one?
Well, I would argue that in India, it has less to do with nonviolence and the things we're most aware of because of its influence on the civil rights movement here, and more to do with his bedrock social issues, untouchability, the mass poverty of the rural India, and relations with Muslims. And in that sense, I think people who struggle on those issues in India invariably view Gandhi as the social conscience of India. Now, in South Africa, it's a different story. In order to achieve the sort of rainbow nation result that they that South Africa ostensibly aspires to be, it's important for them to secure Gandhi as a founding father of the new South Africa. And so they stress his alliances with Africans during his time in South Africa. And a lot of that is a created mythology serving a present-day national goal because he really didn't have alliances with Africans when he lived there. But nevertheless, there are statues of Gandhi around South Africa, banners with his picture on it. He's hailed as one of the creators of South African nationalism.
Thanks so much, Joe. That's Joseph Lelieveld, whose new book, Great Soul, Mahatma Gandhi and His Struggle with India, is reviewed on the cover of this week's book review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So in this age of entrepreneurial self-publishing, it looks like someone has pulled away from the pack.
Yes, and it's probably the best-known author who's self-published her own books. Amanda Hocking, who's a 26-year-old and lives in Minnesota, has become very famous in the last year for publishing her own books. She's a writer of young adult paranormal and dystopian novels. And in the last year, she's sold more than 1 million copies of her own books, mostly in ebook format. And she sold them on Amazon, on BarnesandNoble.com, and she's become incredibly well-known for doing so and for completely circumventing the traditional publishing industry.
So many of the sales have been ebooks, as you say. The prices vary dramatically for different ebooks. What are hers selling for?
Well, while a traditional newly released book from a bigger publisher would probably go for $12.99 or $14.99, she's been selling her books on Amazon, for instance, for $2.99 or for 99 cents. And the way this benefits the writer is that the writer keeps 70% of those revenues and Amazon keeps the other 30%. So those are obviously much more favorable rates for a writer than with a traditional publisher where they would get a much smaller cut.
Right, 12 or 15% or something like that.
Right, or a little higher if you're a bigger name, but that would be typical.
Now, Julie, we at the Book Review often hear from self-published authors. I'll probably get half a dozen books sent to me a week, and most of them don't achieve success like that. What's her magic formula?
She's the incredibly rare exception to the rule, which is that if you publish your own books, they'll generally just go off into an abyss and no one will ever find them. But somehow she's caught on and no one is quite sure what her magic formula is. She's found a following, people who have found her books through her Facebook page, through Twitter. She has this really extensive online presence, and her books have really achieved kind of a cult following. And, you know, she's sold more than 1 million copies, which is incredible for any publisher, self-published or not.
Now, Julie, with a phenomenon like that,
I would think the traditional publishers would be aware of her now. Will she switch over?
Yeah, so they've been courting her for some time. And just in the last week, Amanda decided that she wanted to go with a traditional publisher. So she got a literary agent a few months ago, Stephen Axelrod. And he started shopping her next series, a four-book series, to publishers like Simon & Schuster, Random House, HarperCollins, and a very heated auction has taken place over the last week. But as the price went up and up and up into the seven figures, slowly they dropped out. And the last publisher left standing as of late Wednesday or early Thursday was St. Martin's Press, which is part of Macmillan, winning the rights to publish these four books. And they paid over $2 million to do so.
Wow. So she's hit the big time. Good for her.
She's hit the big time. And, you know, in the initial reaction to this, traditional publishers are very pleased with this. Of course, the main reason is that they feel very validated, that everyone talks about how self-publishing is the future, that you don't need a Random House in order to get your book out. But here we have an author who achieved great success self-publishing and in the end decided that she didn't want to do a lot of the grunt work that publishers do. She wrote on her blog a couple of days ago after the initial news leaked that she was shopping her book, and she wrote, "I want to be a writer. I do not want to spend 40 hours a week handling emails, formatting covers, finding editors, etc. Right now, being me is a full-time corporation." So publishers read that as, okay, that's what we do all the time. That's the value that we offer. So they're very pleased by this whole deal.
Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Now, I understand you hold this convention every year to announce what the annual GIP will be. I have often wondered where the depositors hold that convention. I had an account in the bank once, and the banker, he asked me to withdraw it. Said I used up more red ink than the account was worth. I see where your wife come with you. You notice I say come, not were brought.
That was the great populist humorist Will Rogers dressing down the evil bankers of his day during the Great Depression. He's the subject of a new biography, Will Rogers, A Political Life, by Richard D. White. It's reviewed for us by our great colleague, John Schwartz, who's here to talk about it. Welcome, John.
Thanks.
Okay, Will Rogers, funny guy, but also kind of serious, too, in his concern.
Well, and that's the point. Most people know him as the rope trick guy, the guy who never met a man he didn't like, and he's been flattened into this caricature. The point of White's book is to say, this is someone with tremendous political influence. You couldn't avoid him. He was everywhere, and he was stating opinions.
Okay, John, we're going to hear some more from Will Rogers. What's he got to say now?
Well, he's still beating up the bankers.
I see where your convention was opened by a prayer. You had to send outside your ranks to get somebody that knew how to pray. You should have had one creditor there. He'd have shown you how to pray. I noticed in the prayer the clergyman announced to the Almighty that the bankers were here. Well, it wasn't exactly an announcement. It was more in the nature of a warning. He didn't tell the devil, as he figured to. He knew where you all were all the time anyhow.
So we're talking about an era when radio was a hugely influential medium.
That's right. From the 1920s into 1935. And radio was everything. President Roosevelt used radio in the fireside chats. Will Rogers would sometimes do the intro and or would do a talk just before him and sound many of the same themes as a way of supporting Roosevelt.
What were some of the causes Rogers got involved in? Because they're discussed in this book. Some of them are a little surprising.
Some of them are a little surprising. I mean, among other things, he tried to warn people in the 1920s that we were spending beyond our means. He tried to warn of entanglements in foreign wars. He wanted to expand civil aviation and military aviation. He thought airplanes were going to be a big thing. Turns out to be right about that, although he died in an airplane in 1935. But he also
was a big fan of Mussolini, for instance, and talked about the things that Mussolini did that he admired. So it was very hard to pin him down as being under one label.
And how knowledgeable was he about the political views he espoused? Was this somebody who read and, you know, met with serious-minded people and had a real philosophy, or was he being a homespun guy with a lot of opinions?
Well, he was smarter than you'd think. You know, the image of him is kind of just a cornpone guy who dropped out of 10th grade. But in fact, he really did travel the world, spoke with some of the leading intellectuals of the day, had an open door at the Senate, at the White House, and not just because he was popular. People didn't just suck up to him because he was on the radio. He was actually exchanging ideas with people and was respected for it.
Thanks a lot, John.
You bet.
That's John Schwartz, who reviews Will Rogers, A Political Life, in this week's book review. Jennifer Schussler is back with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the list this week?
Move over, David Brooks. Make room for the real social animal, Sammy Hagar. Remember him? He is on top of the nonfiction list with his autobiography. It's called Red, My Uncensored Life in Rock.
And tell us a little bit about him for some geezers like me who may not quite know who he is.
Well, he's a sort of Southern California hard rocker who back in 1985, in what was a big news event in my childhood, took over the lead microphone of Van Halen from David Lee Roth. And ever since then, they've been locked in a kind of Bush v. Gore style battle. One of them is in the band, then he's out, and the other one's back in. And here, Sammy dishes all the dirt on that. And interestingly, I went back and looked, and David Lee Roth's own autobiography, Crazy from the Heat, didn't even make the bestseller list back in 1997. So I think
score one for Sammy.
Indeed.
What about the fiction list?
James Patterson is back on top. Did he ever really go away? Maybe not. He's got a new book out. It's called Toys. It is a dystopian thriller set in the year 2061. And I have to say, if current sales trends persist, James Patterson is going to have about 500 more bestsellers by the year 2061. This is his eighth bestseller for the past year. All but one of those entered at number one. This guy is really unstoppable.
Has anyone considered that he might actually be a genius?
You have. I don't know. I love it.
What about nonfiction? James Patterson can't be ruling the roost there.
No, Laura Hillenbrand is on top of that list with her smash hit Unbroken, and she is followed by Heaven is for Real, which has been on that list for a bunch of weeks now. Remember, this is the story of a three-year-old son of an evangelical pastor who has a near-death experience during an emergency appendectomy and meets Jesus and comes back to tell everybody about it. Strangely, we seem to be having this heavenly moment in Earthbound bookstores. This is only one of heaven-related books that's doing really well. We've got The Boy Who Came Back from Heaven, 90 Minutes in Heaven, and now at number two on the How To and Miscellaneous list, Love Wins, a book about heaven, hell, and the fate of every person who ever lived. It's by the evangelical pastor Rob Bell.
And there's some controversy about this.
Yes, even before the book came out, there was a lot of talk, a lot of angry talk in the evangelical world about this book. Bell, he's the founding pastor of a megachurch in Michigan. He's 40 years old, very hip guy, kind of a rock star among younger evangelicals. And even before the book came out, he released a promotional video that kind of caused a sensation. And in this book, he's questioning the dogma that only virtuous Christians, a very select few, will go to heaven. And he asks, you know, can it really be true that Gandhi is going to hell? You know, he doesn't think so. And he sort of advances this argument for that. And this has made a lot of people in his world quite angry. He's been accused of staging a theological striptease. For a while, he was a top trending topic on Twitter. I'm not really sure if that counts as being in heaven or being in hell.
Thanks a lot, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.